Mr. Panettiere.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Chris Panettiere. I represent Karen and Jonathan Robinson. My client, Karen Robinson, is still suffering from a disease that a jury found was caused by over-the-counter children's Motrin sold and manufactured by McNeil. That jury found that McNeil was negligent and that Karen Robinson deserved $3.5 million in damages. Yet this is an appeal by the plaintiff instead of the defendant because of a finding of contributory negligence. For two reasons, contributory negligence should not have stood as a complete bar to her recovery. The first reason is that there was no evidence to support the contributory negligence finding.
I don't understand something. If she didn't read the label, the warning, what difference does it make what it said?
She did read the label. She read it when she purchased it, and she evaluated for its safety at that time. And then neither the court below nor McNeil has alleged any negligence by her in failing to read it before taking the first dose. Their entire case is premised on her decision to take doses 2 and 3. But the undisputed fact at trial is that she had this disease, and the disease progressed before she ever took doses 2 and 3.
But she read the warning. When she read the warning, it was about the child. It wasn't about herself.
She testified at trial that when she evaluated that warning, she evaluated it for her whole family. And there was no evidence at trial that there was any...
She was planning to take the child's drug?
She said at trial that she was evaluating it for the safety of her whole family and that she certainly believed that since it was safe for a child, it would be safe for an adult. I actually asked at trial, I asked our expert, Dr. Salisbury, is there any difference in terms of danger whether an adult takes this or a child? And he said no. And there was no contrary evidence to the other side of that.
What do you think the warning should have said?
We believe that the warning should have actually stated a true and accurate picture.
What should it have said?
The warning should have said, warning, this product can cause you to be burned up to 80% of your skin on the inside and the outside.
That's absurd.
Well, that's absolutely what it does. That's what the jury found in this case, Your Honor.
This is one of the most common drugs on the market, right?
It is.
Advil and all that.
And it has a
known... One in a million people have this reaction maybe to the drug, and you're going to have a warning like that?
Your Honor, actually,
there's probably no drug that can't trigger a one in a million allergic reaction. There are terrible consequences.
The incidence of SJS-10 was disputed, whether it was as low as 1.2 per million or as high as 6 or 7. And the jury found that this product caused her disease, and that's not highly disputed.
I do not understand how... All drugs that can cause extremely rare allergic reactions have to carry these frightening warnings. I mean, that would be a revolution in drug labeling.
Your Honor, it has to give a fair appreciation of the true risk of the drug. And that is the true risk of the drug.
The true risk of the drug is the seriousness of this divided by 1 million, which is really pretty small. How many other one-in-a-million chances does this drug, does ibuprofen, cause?
Your Honor, there are a number of different side effects ranging in severity, but this is the most severe side effect that it can cause, and it can also cause death. That's
well, if you would address my question, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor.
How many other one-in-a-million conditions does ibuprofen cause?
I don't know offhand how many other different conditions like this it causes that occur at a rate of 1 in a million. But
your argument seems to be then you can put causation to one side, that warnings should go down to the 1 in a million level. And then in order to figure out whether that's so, we need to know how many 1 in a million conditions there are. Because if there are a lot, then the warnings would be very long, and the longer the warning, the less likely it is to be read. But I also wonder whether the state judiciary of any state has required warnings of 1 in a million conditions.
Well, Your Honor, as an example, and we proved this up at trial
Look, I just asked you a question about law. You can't answer that by saying, here's what we proved at trial. Have state Supreme Courts required warnings of one in a million conditions? That's the question.
Well, certainly that's – yes, in affirming jury verdicts for rare conditions. That's a question for the jury, Your Honor.
What state Supreme Court decisions would you like me to read to support the proposition that warnings for one in a million conditions are required?
Offhand, I don't have that case offhand, Your Honor. But this appeal isn't about whether or not the case was properly decided on whether or not McNeil's product caused this disease. The appeal is about whether there's any evidence of causation on contributory negligence.
Yes, but look, suppose the label said there's a one in a million chance of having a horrible reaction. Would that have altered her behavior?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I don't understand. Then nobody would take any drug, right?
The issue in this case and what
if you wanted to take an aspirin and it look, you know, aspirin has one in a million can cause a hemorrhagic stroke, right? That's around a one in a million probably, isn't it?
It's the consumer's right to make a decision.
I think any injection you get can cause toxic shock. So people would be paralyzed.
Your Honor, as an example, McNeil also manufactures St. John's aspirin, which has a warning for...
Do you think an airline ticket should say there's a 1 in 5 million chance of a crash?
I think people... No, I don't.
Why?
Because I think that the possibility of crash is one that people are aware of. The possibility of SJS in 10 is not.
They don't know the statistics.
They don't know the statistics, but people are well aware of the possibility of allergic reactions to drugs. You can't go to a physician or a dentist without having questions, without being grilled about what are you allergic to and so on. And, of course, this label says you can have an allergic reaction to ibuprofen. So the generic problem, the problem of allergic reactions, is covered, just like the generic problem of things can fall out of the sky is covered. I hope you see the problem. If you've got a long list of one in a million possibilities, you really have a completely impractical warning.
Your Honor, in all due respect, the difference between the plane crash example and this is an allergic reaction can be anything. A plane crash, if the plane crashes, likelihood is you're going to be dead. Not with an allergic reaction.
No, actually, most people survive most plane crashes.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Excluding the...
All plane crashes involve running off the end of the runway or... Actually, in Alaska, most bush pilots have a plane crash or two every year.
The Alaskan bush pilots are well known for their skill in flying their planes. I acknowledge that. But as far as commercial airliners, people have an appreciation that there can be...
Does she have a history of allergies that would concern her?
She had an episode where she believed she might have had an allergic reaction to Cipro while she was on a cruise ship. She didn't know whether she had an allergic reaction to it or not, but she, in due diligence, every time she went to the doctor, she said, I may be allergic to Cipro, I don't know. But in this case, she looked at this bottle, and it said, could cause an allergic reaction.
Why didn't she go to her doctor and say, I want to know whether I might be allergic to this? She's so concerned with allergies.
The manufacturer has always been responsible for its warning and its label. It is that is incumbent on
the possibility of allergic reaction. So if you worry about allergies or drug allergies, you ask your doctor what's this about.
But Your Honor, I think that the FDA has spoken on this in part, and this is the part of the evidence in this case, and it's been discussed in both briefs, which is that the FDA, subsequent to Karen Robinson's use of this product in this case, actually said you need better warnings for this disease because your warnings aren't good enough. And they were required by the FDA to produce better warnings that said that detailed the symptoms of SJS in 10. This warning was not an adequate warning, and that was in the purview of the jury to determine. But the issue in this case is that there was no evidence of contributory negligence, the causation for it. That is what the appeal is about.
And in the evidence is the fact that she kept taking this even after her serious allergic reaction.
Absolutely. And that is failure to mitigate damages. That is not a contributory negligence issue. She already had the disease, and that was undisputed. And I think further that defense counsel...
I think that's correct. I don't think you have a correct understanding of the difference. Failure to... So a standard failure to mitigate damages is you don't fasten your seatbelt. There's an accident, and you're injured more seriously than if you had your seatbelt on. The accident occurs and is over. You're hit, and because you don't have this seatbelt, you're injured more badly. But here, the accident, the incident, it kept developing over the period in which she was taking the drug, right? So she should have stopped after the first allergic reaction, and if she had, there's a possibility or probability that it would have stopped there, and she wouldn't have been, and she wouldn't have had these terrible injuries.
There's no such evidence in the record that it would have stopped. It was McNeil's burden of proof to prove that but for doses 2 and 3, she wouldn't have got this disease. The undisputed evidence at trial, she had the disease as of the day of the first dose. She had it before doses 2 and 3. At best, they can argue that she failed to mitigate damages. But it is undisputed she had the disease. Their experts said it, and our experts said it. This is a classic case of a failure to mitigate damages. But that is not contributory negligence. They are not arguing that she was contributory negligent in taking dose 1. And as Judge Holderman stated in his ruling
What difference would it make? Because if she'd stopped after the first dose and hadn't, and that had been the limit of her injury, then there wouldn't have been any damages.
I disagree, because the evidence at trial was up until she took the second dose. She started having symptoms that started with a rash. It became discolored. It spread. She developed a fever. The symptoms were getting worse and worse and worse all the way up to the second dose. But it was McNeil's burden of proof to prove that but for doses 2 and 3, she wouldn't have got the disease. But to the contrary, she already had it after taking dose 1. That was their burden of proof. And there's no evidence in the record where they're alleging negligence in her taking dose 1. Judge Holderman said any negligence that the jury would find would have been taking doses 2 and 3 because she had developed symptoms after taking dose 1. And to really put an exclamation point on it, at trial, I argued in closing that they shouldn't hold her contributory negligent. Mr. Pulliam, the lawyer for McNeil, stood up and said, He stood up and said, I want to respond first to an accusation that's been made over and over again that McNeil is blaming Karen Robinson.
That is a ridiculous argument you make about his admission. That's ridiculous.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor.
That's a complete waste of time. Look, the word blame is used in a variety of ways. And what he means, obviously, is that, you know, this is a terrible accident and you know, far disproportionate to any carelessness she may have displayed. So you don't blame her for this. That has nothing to do with judicial admissions. That's a very bad argument.
Actually, Your Honor, there are numerous cases.
I mean, think of the common sense of it, right? You're going to parse what lawyers say in closing arguments and accuse them of making judicial admissions?
He made a judicial admission, Your Honor.
Well, come
and,
on.
And it, furthermore, Your Honor...
That's very bad sense on your part to argue that.
Well, what he said
you
is...
You can't censor... Look, closing arguments are not... They're not arguments addressed to... They're not pleadings. They're not addressed to a judge. They're not designed to frame the issues. They're making an appeal to a group of laymen. And you know, they're not using a word like blame in some
Your Honor,
legal sense. It has no technical legal sense.
Your Honor, there have been cases where...
Counsel, this is not a subject on which you want to argue with the court.
You don't want
to choose an argument that the bench has already told you is a dead loser and thrash it.
Thank you, Your Honor. What I will go back to is the lack of any but-for evidence put forth by McNeil of causation. That's the first thing. But let me move on briefly to our second issue.
Well, they had an expert. They had a very distinguished German person, very big expert on this, and her view is that the her view went farther than the jury thought when she said she didn't think this was the cause at all. But she certainly thought that the repeated taking of the drug had serious consequences.
Your Honor,
you didn't even deny that. You just want to call it mitigation of damage or failure to mitigate.
Your Honor, that the one phrase that they have used as evidence is taken completely out of context. It is against that expert's ultimate opinion. It is against the rubric that expert set up for causation. It is completely a cut and paste to try to find something the jury could have relied on. But before I sit down, Your Honor, let me just say that we should have been able to amend the proposed pretrial order when the judge applied Virginia law after we had elected not to pursue our breach of warranty claim in the proposed pretrial order. We brought a claim.
What difference would it make? What does an implied warranty give you? It's a warranty of merchantability, but you're not arguing that this ibuprofen was defective ibuprofen, were you?
Non-ibuprofen,
in fact?
We were arguing that its design was defective, not a manufacturing design.
But that's an implied warranty of merchantability is a different theory from a theory of product design defect.
We brought that theory in our proposed pretrial order, and the court held that product liability, and it's on A7 of our index, product liability, strict liability, was barred in Virginia. It is not. It is absolutely recognized, and we had preserved those claims. Your Honor, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
I don't understand your theory that there was a product defect. What's that about?
Okay, under either Virginia law or Illinois law, whether you bring
this is not a legal question.
Okay, sure. It was based on the first that there was nothing about the product that suggested any danger. The warning is part of that.
That's the warning. But what's the product defect? Warning is a completely different theory of product.
Product defect is that there was a safer product they could have been selling called dexiibuprofen or simply acetaminophen.
Wait a second. What? That ibuprofen should be taken off the market because there are other painkillers? Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, that is...
Take Advil off the market? That's ridiculous.
We're not saying take it off the market.
So OX2 inhibitors instead.
Those are different. Some of those have extraordinarily high risks, and perhaps those should be taken off the market.
Risks.
Sure.
Every drug has risks.
Your Honor, all of this evidence...
Ibuprofen is defective across the board because it has risks, is rather at war with the FDA's conclusion that it has the best benefit-risk ratio of any painkiller.
Actually, the evidence in the case is that up until you have a fever of 102.5, acetaminophen is just as effective and safer than taking ibuprofen.
What is the product defect, though? Are you saying this is an abnormally dangerous product, ibuprofen?
It is under the law, whether you're applying Illinois or Virginia.
So you're saying ibuprofen should be banned.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it should be banned. We're saying that
it's
effective, it should be banned.
Right.
Your Honor, what we're saying is it needs to be accompanied by an actual adequate warning.
No, that's the warning issue. Warning and product defect, they're two different theories of product's liability. If you want the jury to consider whether ibuprofen is a defective product because it's abnormally dangerous, the implication is it shouldn't be sold.
We argued
completely separate from the warranty.
We argued that
from the warning.
Children's Motrin sold over the counter hasn't always been sold over the counter. It only started in the mid 1990s, and we said you don't need to sell this stuff over the counter for children because it causes this disease. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Shores.
May it please the Court. I'd like to start by talking about the nature of the instructions the plaintiffs proposed should have been given in this case, because I think there was an attempt today to conflate what were really two different theories, and those two theories play out very differently on appeal. The first theory that was pursued at trial was the theory that the label should have, in addition to the other symptoms it described in talking about a potential severe allergic reaction, should have added the word rash. And what we said in point four of the appeal brief, and there's no response in the reply, is that that finding of proximate cause could not possibly be affirmed because of the undisputed testimony from Karen Robinson that she did not read, consider, or remember the warnings when she took the drug on September 12th, 13th, and 14th of 2005. And so the simple addition of a symptom to a warning that already said may cause a severe allergic reaction cannot possibly have changed her decision to take ibuprofen in the first instance when she wasn't aware of what the warning actually did say. The second reason that I think they're not talking about that theory on appeal is that it completely...
So your opponent said that she testified that she had read the warning when she bought the drug and that she remembered it.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why I'm trying to break these up, because I think that only goes to the second theory. Mrs. Robinson never said that if the warning label that already said can cause a severe allergic reaction would have also said rash, that she would never have purchased the drug. And that makes no sense, and that's why she didn't testify to it. It said it could cause shock. It said it could cause hives. And there was simply no evidence that the additional inclusion of that symptom would have changed her threshold decision to purchase the drug in the first place.
But you just said that she didn't read it. Now I'm confused.
I apologize, Your Honor. The testimony at trial was that when she purchased the drug 4 or 5 months before, she did read it in purchasing it for her son. The undisputed evidence at trial was also that when she took it 4 to 5 months later, she did not read, remember, or even consider the warnings.
Okay, so you're saying she didn't remember the warnings.
Exactly.
But your opponent said she testified that she didn't remember the warnings. So which is correct?
She did not remember the warnings, Your Honor. What she said was that and this is again why I'm trying to separate these theories, what she said was, if it had said this can cause severe scarring across my whole body, I would never have purchased it in the first place, because when I read that drug 4 or 5 months ago, if I would have seen scarring on 80% of the body, I would never have made that purchase. And that's how they tried to satisfy their burden of proof on proximate cause. But I think it's important to distinguish between those two theories, because a major part of their theory at trial was that the drug should simply have said may cause a rash as an additional symptom.
What does the FDA have to do with regard to your argument? I mean, what the warning should be?
Sure, Your Honor. So it bears very differently, again, on these two theories. What the FDA concluded after doing a comprehensive review of all ibuprofen products in 2005 was that additional symptom of rash should be included in the label. But what the FDA then concluded, both as part of that comprehensive review and in response to a citizen's petition, filed in part by some of the plaintiff's experts in this case, it specifically rejected, and this is at the supplemental appendix, pages 92 and 93, the proposed inclusion of SJSTN and of the words life-threatening in the label. And what the FDA said was twofold. First, they said people wouldn't be familiar with those diseases, so in terms of an OTC product, an over-the-counter product, it wouldn't be helpful to talk about that kind of a disease. And second of all, because SJSTN is so unpredictable, and all the plaintiff's experts agreed with that concept, there's no way to write a warning that tells a particular user, for example, a pregnant woman, that she should be cautious in using the product, because it's a 1 in a million chance, if that, and we don't know where it's going to strike, and we don't know who's going to have a reaction, an idiosyncratic reaction to a particular drug. But given and what the FDA said was the very favorable risk-benefit profile of ibuprofen, it was in the public health interest to keep the product on the market and not to dissuade people from using the drug out of the 1 in a million, if that, chance of this disease developing. And so those are the theories that we have here, and I think the reason it's important to break them apart is because when the plaintiffs tried this case and they argued that the label should have said the word rash, they were never contending at trial, and their experts did not say this, that her development of SJSTN was inevitable after the first dose of that medication. On the contrary, the point of that warnings theory, and this is in the openings, it's in the closings, it's in the cross-examination of our witnesses, it's in the direct examinations of their own witnesses, is that if the label had said, stop if you have a rash, she would have read it after taking the first dose and averted her injuries. And now what they're contending on appeal is completely a pivot from that. Their contention is her development of SJSTN was inevitable after that first dose of a medication. And as the verdict winner, McNeil is entitled to a review of the record in the light most favorable to it.
Was there conflicting evidence as to whether or not she contracted the disease after one dose?
Absolutely, Your Honor. What our expert testified to, Dr. Maja Mokenhomb, who the district court noted is one of the leading experts in the world on SJSTEN, she's cared for hundreds of patients. She has been the co-author of all three of the leading studies of this disease, is that one dose of ibuprofen or one dose of a drug cannot cause SJSTEN. And she testified about that not only based on her ultimate conclusion that the drug doesn't pose these risks even if you take it repeatedly, but based on the fact that the body doesn't mediate a response to SJSTEN in the same way that it does for some allergic reactions that are instantaneous or very quick. And what she said is, in her experience, based on her review of the pharmacological reaction, that it took a continuous dose over a course of days rather than one dose, a single time, for the disease to be triggered. And even setting aside what Dr. Mokenhomb said...
Hadn't she taken ibuprofen in the past? Had she ever taken it?
She had, Your Honor. And another point of dispute at the trial was...
But had it built up over years?
That was a point of disagreement at the trial, Your Honor. But I think, you know, as the verdict winner, we would be entitled to resolution of that dispute in our favor. But what our experts said was that this is not the kind of reaction that can be sensitized. Or that you, and she also explained what the plaintiff's lawyers opined was that, and this is important, although Drs. Nelson and Tackett conceded that development of this disease usually takes a week, both of them conceded that, they claim that it can sometimes happen faster than that if there's a rechallenge situation. And their interpretation of a rechallenge situation was you build up a sensitization to this drug over time, and then suddenly you take it, and it's like water over the dam. That's what Dr. Tackett said. Dr. Mokenhaupt said, this is not a rechallenge situation because the literature that they were talking about is literature in which someone has already had an SJSTEN reaction, and then you give them the suspected drug again. And in those circumstances, you can have perhaps more of an immediate reaction. But again, these were disputed questions, and the jury could rationally, at the very least, have concluded that first dose didn't cause the disease, but the second...
She continued on with the Childs Motrin?
She did, Your Honor. She took three doses over the course of 3 years.
I thought initially the reason she didn't go down and use her own adult medication was because the medicine cabinet was on a different floor or something.
That's true, Your Honor. What she testified to is that when she woke up in the early morning hours of September 12th, she had a headache so severe that she chose to use the children's Motrin, which was upstairs, rather than go downstairs. And that's also why she explained candidly that she didn't read, remember, or even consider the warning label at the time. She had a throbbing headache.
Was there any evidence why she continued using it rather than go back to whatever her regular...
There was not, Your Honor. But I think, you know, the critical thing on this sensitization question is, even if you set aside what Dr. Mokenhomb talked about, and obviously the jury didn't believe all of what Dr. Mokenhomb explained, but they were entitled to accept part, even if not all, of that testimony. Even if you just look at what the plaintiff's experts talked about in this case, the jury could rationally have concluded that those second and third doses were necessary before SJSTEN developed. Dr. Nelson conceded at pages 88 and 89 of the transcript that the progression of this disease usually takes a week, but can be faster if it's a rechallenge situation. Dr. Tackett testified clearly that this was an unpredictable disease. The critical thing to do, and this is at page 227 of the transcript, is to stop using the drug immediately. And at 246 through 255, all he said was, this is like water building up, and at some point it goes over the dam. He never said that happened after the first dose, not the second dose. So even if you look at what the plaintiff's experts were talking about, there was simply no testimony that progression of SJSTEN was inevitable after the first dose of that medication. There was also other evidence in the case, for example, by Dr. Temple, who was one of McNeil's scientists and recently retired, at page 720 of the transcript, where McNeil reported 89 rashes to the FDA and only 5 cases of epidural necrolysis. And so the idea that if you're starting to have a light red rash after one dose of a medication, that it's inevitable that you're going to contract SJSTEN further down the line, even if you stop using the product, is disproven by that evidence as well. And again, what we're talking about here is not who should have won the jury trial, but whether, without weighing the evidence and viewing the record in the light most favorable to McNeil, there was sufficient evidence from which a jury could rationally have concluded that those second and third doses were required before SJS.
She saw a physician fairly quickly after the rash appeared, didn't she?
She saw a physician after taking that second dose, Your Honor. But I think it's important to note here that setting aside the judicial admissions point, the plaintiffs don't raise any challenge to the jury's threshold finding of contributory negligence. Their sole challenge is to the proximate cause finding. And so if you set aside that judicial admissions point, there is no challenge to that threshold finding of contributory negligence. They did raise those points following trial, but they have not raised them on appeal. And so the sole question is, could a jury rationally have concluded that those additional doses were required before SJST and developed? And the answer is yes. Another point that I think bears noting...
Did she sue the doctor also?
She did not, Your Honor. Another point that bears noting, and this is at page 1352 of the transcript, is that the very argument the plaintiffs are making on appeal, they made to the jury in closing. They argued to the jury in closing that the jury should answer the contributory negligence question no, because by the time Karen Robinson took that first dose, her SJSTEN was already developing, and that nothing she could have done after that would have averted her injuries. The jury rejected that, and that was based on the evidence that was presented. And so, you know, a review of the record in the light most favorable to McNeil, I think, clearly supports that conclusion. Another point I wanted to get back to, Your Honor, just because you were talking about the question of what damages she would have been entitled to, I don't understand plaintiffs to be making the point that she was already injured in the sense of she could have sued for the rash that she had on September 12th, but rather to be making the point that the progression of that disease was inevitable after September 12th. And I think at the very least, the evidence doesn't inevitably support the plaintiff's assertions there. But I do think there is a point of harmless error here, even if you otherwise bought that argument, and I don't think there's a reason to for lots of reasons. But the debate that the parties were having at the close of the trial was about whether there should be a mitigation instruction or whether there should be a contributory negligence instruction. And that was at page 1199 of the transcript. And even the plaintiff's counsel, Mr. Panettiere, agreed that if contributory negligence wasn't in the case, mitigation should have been. We know that the jury concluded that the additional doses are what moved Mrs. Robinson's case from a light rash to SJSTEN. And given that there was no evidence presented, Mrs. Robinson certainly wasn't suing on what happened on September 12th in terms of a light red rash, there would have been no difference in this verdict if that substitution had been made. And the Lawrence case, which the plaintiff...
Where was the rash?
It was on her chest, Your Honor.
How extensive was it?
She described it as a light skin discoloration, and she said she otherwise felt fine that day until she went back to bed the following evening. And what the Lawrence versus Worth case says is, under Virginia law, if you're in a mitigation situation, obviously I don't think we're in a mitigation situation, but even if you are, it's not a comparative fault kind of analysis. The plaintiff cannot recover from the point at which...
Did she take the second dose because she still had a headache? Or
she took the second dose because she woke up and the rash was there and she had a fever. She was developing a fever at that point, Your Honor. And so what the Lawrence case says is, from that point forward...
Is ibuprofen a treatment for fever?
It is, Your Honor. And that, you know, obviously our principal submission, both at trial, and we noted this in the red brief, is that there isn't sufficient evidence that ibuprofen causes this disease in the first instance. What you have are some observational studies. This is so rare and so misunderstood that it can't be studied through a traditional placebo-type clinical study because you just won't pick up the incidence. But what Dr. Mokenhaupt has done is analyzed every hospitalization over a several-country region in Western Europe for a number of years and then done a case-control comparison to see if there's a signal from ibuprofen.
And what is it, 1 in a million? Is that...
Your Honor, the 1 in a million number comes from the FDA talking about all causes of the drug. And so, obviously, our contention is that the number from ibuprofen would be much smaller than that. And what Dr. Mokenhaupt concluded in 2008 in the study that she contends is the best, most reliable indication, there is no statistically significant association between ibuprofen and this disease. And it's particularly troubling and difficult to study this from an observational standpoint when, as Your Honor indicated, you can have what's called confounding by indication, which is sometimes SJSTEN can begin with symptoms which would logically be treated with Motrin. And so you can have a situation where somebody is admitted to a hospital and they tell the treating physician, after the physician has made a TEN diagnosis, I took Motrin. And that would be checked as a yes in the case control study in terms of an association between the drug. But that doesn't tell us anything
about... What is
about
the prevalence of SJSTEN?
From all causes, Your Honor, it was more or less undisputed. I think there were some tiny variations. But if you look at the response to the citizen's petition, the numbers that we've cited in the red brief for TEN are 1 per 1.2 million patient years. And so it's extraordinarily rare. And another thing that I think that gets back to is when
That's the disease from all causes.
That's the disease from all causes, Your Honor.
But you're saying we don't know what fraction of that is caused by ibuprofen.
We don't know precisely. I mean,
could be zero.
We believe it's zero, Your Honor. But I think what it goes back to is what Mr. Panettiere started with today was she had this disease on September 12th. That's simply not undisputed at this trial. And if you look at the record sites that in their opening brief and in their reply brief, they contend supports that assertion, they simply don't. What Dr. Tackett is talking about on those pages, and it's in the 240s, and most critically, I think, at 255, is that a sensitized individual can sometimes have a reaction that's faster than the 1 week it usually takes to contract this disease. He didn't say that's inevitable. He didn't say that happened here. And he didn't say that once you have a rash, it will inevitably turn into SJSTEN. And so in light of the fact that this is a drug and a reaction that's still being studied, you look at the overall record and say, could the jury have rationally reached the conclusion that SJSTEN was not inevitable and would not have occurred until Mrs. Robinson took those second and third doses of the drug? And I think the answer is yes.
Was the jury told that contributory negligence is a complete defense?
Your Honor, what the jury was told, and this was because there were some last-minute changes to the instructions in the verdict form the morning of the closings, was that they were not to compare the negligence of McNeil with the negligence of Mrs. Robinson. They were to make the determination whether she was negligent, and if so, whether that was a proximate cause of her injuries. There were no objections to that instruction. And they were told the court will make the determination whether it's a complete bar. And there were no objections to that instruction either. And candidly, there probably could have been a different way to do that, but it was the morning of. There were some changes to the instructions in the verdict form going on at the last minute, and there was certainly no objection to that. And in closings, plaintiff's counsel did tell the jury that it would be a complete bar.
He did?
Yes. And so I don't contend that the jury would have overridden the court's instructions, but at the very least, it's unclear what the jury thought would happen. But there were certainly no objections made to that instruction as it was given by either party. I'd like to turn briefly, if I could, to the plaintiff's second issue, which is that the district court abused its discretion in declining to permit plaintiffs to reassert a previously withdrawn implied warranty claim. This is an abuse of discretion standard, and I think the plaintiffs can't even get to square one with it because, as this court said in the Harper case, which is the case Judge Holderman relied on, and as the Fifth Circuit said in the Quick Technologies case, the district court has discretion to enforce a forfeiture or waiver order. And what the district court held in this case was, on July 31st, the plaintiffs did two things. First, they filed a pretrial order that specifically said they were withdrawing their implied warranty claim. Second, they submitted instructions that did not include the implied warranty claim. And they did that despite both actual and constructive knowledge that Virginia law might be applied in the case. Several months early on May 6th, in footnote 4 of our summary judgment brief, we had indicated that because there was not a conflict between Illinois and Virginia law, a choice of law analysis wasn't required at that time, but that McNeil would make choice of law arguments should the case proceed to trial. That's exactly what McNeil did. And it's not as though the differences between Virginia law and Illinois law were insubstantial in this case. Just to give the most obvious example, Virginia caps punitive damages at $350,000. And so the idea that plaintiffs were unaware, given the obvious connection between this case and Virginia, where Mrs. Robinson lived, ingested Motrin, and suffered her injuries, that wasn't out there as an issue just simply isn't persuasive. And McNeil, on the other hand, I see that my time has expired, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Panettiere?
Yes, Your Honor. very briefly, it is absolutely undisputed she had the disease on the day of the first dose. In fact, it was their contention at trial that she had the disease before the first dose and that perhaps it came from some Thai food she ate or some multivitamin she was taking. It was absolutely undisputed. You can look at transcript page 1144. That's their expert. But let me just say, we also proved up through Dr. Mokenhoff's own studies a 400% increased risk for people taking ibuprofen and developing this disease. It is absolutely causally related, and there was a foundation for the jury's verdict. And lastly, in all of the discussion, we never heard anything that would back up their burden of proof that doses 2 and 3 were a but-for cause of her disease. She had the injury before doses 2 and 3, and they do not allege that she was contributory and negligent in taking dose number 1, Your Honors. If there's any other questions, I'm obviously happy to take those.
Counsel, the case is taken under advisement.
Thank you.